Today is Thursday, December 1st, and this is the World Socialist Website. Democrats move to ban rail strike and impose a settlement opposed by workers, by Patrick Martin. The vote by the House of Representatives Wednesday morning to ban a nationwide rail strike and impose a White House-backed settlement on 120,000 rail workers is a historic political event. The Democratic Party, which controls the House and drove the vote, has openly displayed its class role as the instrument of corporate America against the working class. The Biden administration has looked on in horror as rail workers voted to reject the settlement it devised in collaboration with Wall Street, the rail corporations, and their union servants. Now this government, which prattles endlessly about freedom and democracy around the world, is moving to ruthlessly suppress the democratic rights of the rail workers. According to the White House and Congress, workers do not have the right to vote on the terms of their employment or the right to strike if the corporate bosses refuse to make an acceptable offer. The mantra repeated by the Democratic and Republican politicians and the corporate media is that a rail strike must be prevented because it will damage the economy. No such argument has been made to stop profit gouging by the oil companies or factory shutdowns or the slashing of wages and benefits by corporate employers, all of which certainly damage the economic interests of working people. But by economy, the representatives of big business mean profits. Wall Street signaled its approval by rising sharply following the House vote. The rail bosses claim they cannot afford to meet the demands of workers, even elementary necessities like paid sick leave, available to 78% of all workers, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. These claims of poverty are ludicrous, coming from the most profitable industry in America, controlled by the banks and billionaires like Warren Buffett. The rail bosses can pay, but they do not want to. That is because the issue is not just the immediate interests of the rail companies, but the entire class strategy of the American bourgeoisie. This strategy has been based on continuing the inflation of asset values, that is, stocks, bonds, and other paper holdings, while suppressing any wage movement in the working class. The monetary policy of the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank, clearly expresses this class strategy. The Fed has systematically raised interest rates this year, citing as its main concern the tightness of the labor market, which would ordinarily find expression in a rise in wages. The Fed is using higher rates to promote a recession, increase unemployment, and thus counteract any wages movement in the working class. A breakthrough by an important section of workers, such as in rail, would threaten to trigger a far wider offensive by the working class, whose rising militancy has been revealed in contract rejections and in strikes by university workers, health workers, transport workers, and sections of industrial workers. This class necessity explains the remarkable speed in the passage of this anti-worker legislation, which was publicly proposed by Biden on Monday evening, passed by the House on Wednesday morning, and will be discussed by the Senate Democrats at a Thursday lunch. The ban on a rail strike is likely to become law by the weekend. Only two other pieces of legislation have achieved such rapid passage in recent years. The rescue plan for the banks and corporations, enacted in March 2020 by congressional Democrats and Republicans, working together and signed into law by Donald Trump, and the emergency military and financial aid to Ukraine, rushed through this year to bolster the U.S.-NATO war against Russia. Congress is an impenetrable barrier when it comes to enacting legislation that would in any way support the democratic rights or social necessities of American working people. But when it comes to the key interests of the American ruling elite, at home and abroad, the supposedly deadlocked Congress reveals itself as a swift and savage instrument of class rule. In the 2020 campaign and after, Biden proclaimed himself the most pro-union president in history. By that, he meant that he would rely on the apparatus of the AFL-CIO to control and discipline the working class and compel it to accept the dictates of big business. But Biden, like the corporate elite which he serves, has concluded that the rail union bureaucracy will not be able by itself to suppress the movement from the rank and file, hence the need for the unfettered use of state power against rail workers. The Democratic Party's entire leadership, the retiring trio of octogenarians, Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and James Clyburn, and their chosen successors, Hakeem Jeffries, Catherine Clark, and Pete Aguilar, backed the bill. The vast majority of the Democratic Party's left wing voted for the anti-strike legislation as well, including Pramila Jayapal, chair of the House Progressive Caucus, Ro Khanna, former chairman of the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the media celebrity and member of the Democratic Socialists of America. None of them spoke in the debate, presumably hoping to escape notice and preserve their progressive credentials in order to scam the working class again. While the bill passed the House by 290 to 137, virtually all the members, Democratic and Republican, supported imposing the terms set by Biden's Presidential Emergency Board, or PEB, and banning a strike. The Republicans, however, were up in arms over a second bill, offered by the Democratic leadership to provide a fig leaf for the strike-breaking bill, by adding 7 days of paid sick leave to the term set by the PEB. The debate on the strike ban revolved entirely around the sick leave plan, which Republicans characterized as a poison pill. A majority of them opposed the strike-breaking bill as a show of opposition to the sick leave plan. Speakers for both parties lauded the terms set by the PEB, using language that went beyond even the lies rolled out by union officials in their campaign for ratification. One Republican congressman described the PEB plan as providing, quote-unquote, very generous provisions for health care and wages, which were, quote, going to set an average wage and benefits compensation level at more than $160,000 a year. Another said that by the end of the four-year deal, quote, the average wages for rail workers will reach $110,000 per year with total compensation averaging $160,000. He concluded, quote, it's unthinkable that the four railroad unions are holding the nation economically hostage. In decades past, the suppression of rail workers has followed the terms laid down in the anti-democratic Railway Labor Act of 1926, which effectively stripped workers in that industry of the right to strike, a prohibition later extended to the airlines. Workers are tied to their jobs through an elaborate process of negotiation, mediation, and federal intervention, which ends either with an agreement on industry terms enforced by the pro-corporate unions, or an agreement dictated in Washington by a PEB or Congress and accepted by the unions as an unalterable fact. This reactionary ritual has been disrupted by the development of rank-and-file militancy, and especially by the emergence of a new form of working-class organization, the Rail Workers Rank-and-File Committee, established with the assistance of the World Socialist website and the Socialist Equality Party. This committee has played the leading role in mobilizing and organizing opposition to the contracts and uniting rail workers across trades and companies. Hundreds of rail workers have attended its online meetings and have joined in public protest against the PEB deal, including pickets at rail facilities. The vote by the House of Representatives demonstrates that rail workers face a struggle, not just against the huge rail corporations and the ossified bureaucracy of 12 rail unions, but against the capitalist government of the United States. This means they are engaged in a political struggle, in which the central task is to break with the political straitjacket of the corporate-controlled two-party system. While these enemies are uncompromising in their ferocious hostility to the rail workers, they are operating from a position of weakness, while the rail workers occupy a position of enormous strength. This stems not only from their critical position in the U.S. and world economy, but from the tremendous support and sympathy they will arouse from other workers, from the very first moment they take the road of independent struggle for their own class interests. A rail strike in America would become a beacon for workers around the world. The central issue is for rail workers to understand the realities of the present confrontation. The rail bosses and the Biden administration are weak, but conscious of their weakness. That is their advantage. Rail workers do not sufficiently understand the strength of their own position, and that is their disadvantage, reinforced by the deliberate sabotage of the old and outmoded union organizations. This struggle must go forward through the development of new forms of organization, rank-and-file committees in every workshop and railroad terminus, and through the development of a new political leadership among rail workers, based on a socialist program. U.S. airline workers join railroaders in the fight against abusive work conditions, by Shannon Jones. Growing militancy among U.S. airline workers over intolerable work conditions and low pay is fusing with the rebellion by railroad workers, who are headed toward a historic confrontation with the Biden administration and the U.S. Congress with the passage of legislation imposing a contract that workers have rejected. Airline workers are in virtually the same situation as railroaders, with flight crews facing short staffing leading to overwork and potentially catastrophic pilot fatigue, while airlines are raking in bumper profits boosted by massive government subsidies. Airline workers, whose pay has long been stagnant, are being ravaged by inflation. Like railroad workers, airline workers are confronting a ruthless corporate management. The union apparatus, which is embedded with that same management, is citing the Reactionary Railway Labor Act, or RLA, to block strikes and tie workers up in endless, fruitless negotiations aimed at wearing down resistance. In the last month, airline workers have rejected contracts and overwhelmingly passed strike authorization votes, demonstrating their determination to fight. Pilots and cabin crew at U.S. Airlines, Delta, American, and United have rejected contracts that failed to address any of their basic needs. On November 16th, American Airlines flight attendants held pickets and rallies at 11 major airports to highlight their demands after they were rejected by management. The Association of Flight Attendants covers 25,000 American Air flight attendants and has been bargaining since before the start of the pandemic for a new agreement. According to AFA President Julie Hedricks, in comments to The Guardian earlier this month, quote, "Our staffing has also been cut. We're back to flying the same amount of flights and hours we flew back in 2019 prior to COVID, with thousands of fewer flight attendants." On October 31st, 15,000 Delta Airlines pilots voted by 99% to authorize strike action. The same week, pilots at United Airlines voted to reject a tentative agreement by 94%. More than 3 years of talks have not led to an agreement. However, pilots face a labyrinthian mediation process under the RLA that places almost impossible obstacles on the path to legal strike action. First, the National Mediation Board must decide that additional mediation efforts would not be productive and release the airline and union to arbitration. If either side declines, there is a mandated 30-day cooling-off period before a strike can legally begin. As in the railroads, the airline union bureaucrats not only refuse to fight the anti-democratic RLA, they welcome it as a means of suppressing a movement of their own members, which they could break out of their own control. This includes Sarah Nelson, the Democratic Socialists of America affiliated leader of the Association of Flight Attendants, Communications Workers of America, or AFA-CWA. It is noteworthy that Nelson's fellow DSA members in Congress, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have voted to back the strike-breaking legislation against railroad workers. The hypocrisy of the Biden administration was demonstrated last week by the remarks of Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, who denounced a possible strike by rail workers as not acceptable. He added, quote, "If we don't have a healthy, functioning, strong rail system, it would not be good." He continued, quote, "We don't have trucks or barges or ships in this country to make up for the rail network." While supporting strike-breaking legislation to impose a pro-company contract on railway workers, the Transportation Secretary has taken a kid-glove approach to airlines, which have wreaked havoc on the air transportation system. The airlines, similar to the railroads, cut thousands of jobs and, over the last 2 years, have engaged in massive price gouging while stranding thousands of passengers with flight cancellations and delays. Well aware of the public anger towards the airline executives, on November 13th, Buttigieg imposed a wrist-slap fine of $7.25 million on six air carriers, on who owe collectively more than $600 million to passengers, and whose trips were impacted by flight delays and cancellation. None of the major U.S. airlines were fined, and all but one of the six were overseas carriers. According to official government data, the plurality of flight cancellations and delays, 40%, are due to the carriers themselves. For the first 8 months of 2022, U.S. airlines reported over 951,000 delayed flights to the Department of Transportation. Now, U.S. airlines and federal regulators are proposing the unprecedented step of reducing cockpit crews to require just one pilot per plane in order to deal with staffing issues, rather than increase the hiring and training of pilots and raising pay. This insane proposal, opposed by everyone concerned with airline safety, dovetails the push for one-man crews on the railroads. Airlines, meanwhile, are reporting bumper profits. American posted $483 million in profit in the third quarter of 2022, off a record revenue of $13.46 billion during the first three quarters of this year. This despite the fact that the number of flights fell by 10% during the same period. Delta reported a $966 million profit in the third quarter, and during the same period, United posted $942 million. The air carriers obtained this result by taking advantage of the inflationary environment to jack up fares. Airfares rose a staggering 42.9% annually, according to a recent consumer price index, while overall inflation was only a little more than 8%. This shameless profiteering follows the massive bailout of the airlines and other large corporations during the pandemic. Since March 2021, U.S. airlines received $54 billion, supposedly to avoid mass layoffs and maintain their operations. That was more than any other single U.S. industry. Despite this, over 80,000 airline workers were furloughed or lost their jobs during the pandemic. The airlines have still not returned to pre-pandemic levels of employment. The manpower shortages and flight delays that are currently plaguing air transport come despite the massive infusion of government cash to prop up the airlines. Instead of using the government largesse to bolster air transport, hire and train more staff, and upgrade systems, a large portion of those taxpayer funds have gone to enrich airline stockholders and executives. In the face of even worse disruptions, ahead of the holiday travel season, there have been demands raised for an investigation of the possible misuse of COVID funds. However, no serious action to recoup billions in bailouts from airline executives can be expected by the Democrats and Republicans, who are politically beholden to these very same airlines. Airline workers must learn the lessons of the railroad workers and their battle against the rail companies. Over the past 3 years, railroad workers have been trapped in endless negotiations and mediation boards aimed at blocking their effort to strike and secure their interests. During this process, the trade union apparatus worked deliberately and consciously with both the Biden administration and the rail companies to try to push through pro-company agreements. Finally, after workers rejected contracts backed by the apparatus, Congress has intervened with the support of the White House and the companies to pass legislation forcing these contracts through. To fight for their interests in unity with railroad workers and all sections of the working class, airline workers should move now to form rank-and-file committees, independent of the pro-corporate union apparatus. At the same time, the defense of the rights of airline workers, as well as the traveling public, requires an end to subordination of public transport to the profit interests of privately run airlines. A rational transport system, including safe conditions for workers, as well as the public, requires placing the airlines and other transport, such as rail and trucking, under the democratic public ownership and control of the working class. Australian PM says legal action against Assange should end, by Oscar Grenfell. Speaking in the Australian Parliament yesterday, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese claimed for the first time that his Labour Party government has made representations to the Biden administration to end legal action against persecuted WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange. Referencing Assange, Albanese repeated past statements that, quote, unquote, enough is enough, and that it is, quote, time for this matter to be brought to a conclusion. Before yesterday, Albanese had not so much as mentioned Assange in months, despite the fact that the journalist is the world's most high-profile political prisoner and an Australian citizen. Albanese's stony silence has persisted amid warnings that Assange's health has deteriorated to the point that he may die as a result of more than 10 years of U.S.-led persecution. Assange, moreover, is being detained in a maximum security prison in Britain, He faces extradition to the United States, where he would be prosecuted under the Espionage Act for publishing true information exposing war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. The maximum sentence is 175 years imprisonment, effectively the death penalty by another name. While this frame-up has proceeded over the last 6 months, the Labour government has vastly expanded Australia's military and intelligence ties with the US and Britain, above all in preparation for conflict with China. Albanese's comments were a response to questions from independent MP Monique Ryan. She stated, quote, "Journalists obtaining and publishing sensitive information in the public interest is essential to democracy. Australian citizen Julian Assange is still contained in Belmarsh Prison, charged by a foreign government with acts of journalism. Mr. Assange's freedom will only come from political intervention. Will the government intervene to bring Mr. Assange home?" Unquote. The Labour PM was at pains to differentiate himself from this favorable and accurate description of the heroic WikiLeaks founder. In the course of a reply that only runs to 3 paragraphs, Albanese stated twice that he had no sympathy for Mr. Assange's actions. Albanese did not elaborate, but the meaning is clear. He is hostile to Assange's journalism, which exposed thousands of civilian deaths, torture, and other war crimes. He opposes WikiLeaks' public interest reportage, which has been described by Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg and other commentators as among the most important in modern history. The clear implication is that the U.S. pursuit of Assange was legitimate, at least for a time. In reality, the Prime Minister was referring to one of the most monstrous frame-ups in recent decades, which included CIA plots to illegally kidnap or assassinate an Australian journalist and publisher in London. Albanese stated, quote, "I do say, though, that this issue has gone on for many years now. And when you look at the issue of Mr. Assange and compare that with the person responsible for leaking the information, Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, she is now able to participate freely in U.S. society." He continued, quote, "The government will continue to act in a diplomatic way. But I can assure the member for Kooyong that I have raised this personally with representatives of the United States government. My position is clear and has been made clear to the U.S. administration that it is time that this matter be brought to a close. This is an Australian citizen." Albanese phrased what has been described by some as a call for Assange's freedom entirely in the negative. Having reiterated his lack of sympathy for the WikiLeaks publisher, he added, quote, "But having said that, you have to reach a point whereby what is the point of this continuing this legal action, which could be caught up now for many years into the future?" Several points need to be made about these comments. The pseudo-legal lynching of a journalist is depicted as little more than an inconvenience, that is, dragging. But more crucially, Albanese's statement maintained the ambiguity that has been present in all of the handful of statements made by leading representatives of the government. He did not explicitly call for the U.S. to withdraw its extradition proceedings, nor did he state that Britain must end its participation in the case and free the Australian citizen immediately. There is every reason to suspect that, to the extent that the Labour government is proposing anything, it is a seedy deal that would leave unchallenged the dire precedent of the U.S. government seeking to prosecute a foreign journalist for exposing its war crimes. In July, lawyer Kelly Tranter obtained internal documents from the Office of Labour Attorney General Mark Dreyfus on Assange. The two memos said nothing about securing Assange's immediate freedom or blocking the U.S. attempt to prosecute him. Instead, their sole preoccupation was the prospect of a prison transfer of Assange from the U.S. to Australia. This would presuppose Assange's extradition to America, even though his family and medical experts have warned that the WikiLeaks founder would suicide if that were to occur. It is similarly assumed that Assange will be convicted of the espionage charges or accept a plea deal admitting guilt when he has committed no crime. This would entrench the assault on press freedom contained in the attempted U.S. prosecution. It would, moreover, take years and years, years that Assange may not have. Only the naive would place their hopes for Assange's freedom on such sordid machinations. While their precise content is unknown, the political character and orientation of the Labour government is not. Since assuming office in May, it has drastically accelerated Australia's frontline role in the U.S. confrontation with China, functioning as Washington's attack dog in the region. Almost every day brings a new announcement of greater U.S.-Australian military collaboration and plans for new weapons systems, along with condemnations and threats directed against Beijing. Assange is locked up for exposing imperialist war. The Labour government is greatly intensifying the program of imperialist war. Albanese, moreover, can say that he has raised the issue of Assange with unnamed representatives of the U.S. administration. But again, his every public utterance has been to insist on the unbreakable character of the U.S.-Australia alliance, which is an instrument of the persecution of Assange and the vehicle through which the Australian ruling elite prosecutes its own predatory interests, especially in the South Pacific. When the military dictatorship in Myanmar arrested Australian economist Sean Turnell, Albanese immediately demanded his release. If an Australian citizen were being imprisoned by a regime in the crosshairs of U.S. and Australian imperialism, there would be talk of sanctions, foreign embassy officials would be reprimanded, and diplomatic threats would be issued. In the case of Assange, no such action has or will be taken. Albanese's comments were made after prominent publications, including the New York Times and The Guardian, issued a statement calling for his freedom and an end to the U.S. prosecution. As the WSWS noted, it took these outlets, which have ruthlessly attacked Assange, a decade to oppose this fundamental attack on democratic rights and press freedom. Undoubtedly, an aspect is their awareness of widespread popular support for Assange. That was also mentioned by Albanese, who said that the Assange case was, quote, of great interest to many Australians. The PM also said that, quote, so many Australians had contacted me about this issue. Those popular sentiments must be developed, but being taken in by Labour's cynical maneuvering will have the opposite effect. It is a path of paralysis and of bowing before the very political forces responsible for the threat to Assange's life. In the course of the Assange case, the perspective of making moral appeals to official politicians has been tried and tried again. It has failed and will continue to do so under conditions of imperialist war and an ever greater turn to authoritarianism. The way forward in the fight for Assange's freedom is to turn to the growing movement of the working class against the very governments that are persecuting the WikiLeaks publisher. Among workers and young people, there is a deep commitment to democratic rights that must be transformed into a political movement fighting for Assange's immediate and unconditional freedom. Only such a struggle will compel an Australian government to fulfill its elementary democratic and legal obligations to the persecuted Australian journalist.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.